quick and as cleanly as he'll let me. You don't know what he does, Ma, but I can tell you I won't soil my hands on him, not if I can help it. Killing him will be like cutting out a tumour in the flesh of humanity.
You cut out a few of those, son?
Harry nodded. And one more to go.
And the girl who doesn't deserve to be dead? That was a strange way of putting it, Harry.
It's such a recent thing for her, Ma. Harry knew he'd strayed into a minefield, looked in vain for a safe landmark. She's not used to it yet, and she doesn't have to get used to it. I mean, I can help her.
You've learned a new thing, Harry,
she answered, but very slowly, and he sensed something different in her voice which was never there before. Fear.
You learned it from Janos Ferenczi? And I can feel it. Yes, and it's what puts you apart from us now. We can all feel it.
And suddenly her dead speak was racked with small shudders. His Ma too? Had he alienated even his warm, sweet Ma? Suddenly he had the feeling that if he let her go, she'd just drift away from him and keep on drifting, perhaps into that beyond place which she sensed waiting there. But he had one trump card left and now played it. Ma, am I good or bad? Was I born good or evil? She read the anxiety in his dead speak and returned at once.
Oh, you were good, son. How can you doubt it? You were always so good.
Well, nothing's changed, Ma. Not yet, and not here. I promise you. I won't let anything change me, not here. If and when I feel it, as soon as I feel I can't hold it any longer, then I'll go.
But if you bring that girl back, what will she be?
Beautiful, just as she was. Maybe not physically beautiful, though it's a fact she was lovely, but alive. And that's to be beautiful, you know that.
But for how long, son? I mean, will she age? Will she die? What will she be? What will she be, Harry?
He had no answer. Just a girl, I don't know.
And her children? What will they be?
Ma, I don't know. I only know she's too much alive to be dead.
Are you doing it for yourself?
No, just for her, and for all of you. He sensed her shaking her head.
I don't know, son. I just don't know.
Trust me, Ma.
Well, I suppose I'll have to. So, how can I help?
Harry was eager now, except, Ma, I don't want to weaken you. You said you were all used up.
So I am. But if you can fight, so can I. If the dead won't talk to you, maybe they'll still talk to me. While they can.
He nodded his gratitude and in a little while said, There were others before Penny Sanderson. I know their names from the newspapers, but I have to know where they were laid to rest and I need an introduction. See, they were badly hurt and probably won't trust anyone like me who can touch them from this side. I mean, the one who killed them. He could do that too. While I do need to talk to them, I don't want to frighten them more than they already are. So you see, without you, it would be just too difficult.
So you want to know which graveyards they're in, right?
Right. It probably wouldn't be too hard to find out for myself, but there are so many things on my mind that keep getting in the way, and so time goes by.
All right, Harry. I'll do what I can, but I don't want to have to track you down any more. So it would be better if you came to see me. That way I...
She paused, cut off abruptly. Ma?
Didn't you feel that, son? I always feel it when they're close by like that.
What was it?
Someone joining us,
she answered sadly. Someone dying?
Something, anyway.
A medium in life. In death, Mary Keogh's contact with death was that much sharper. And what had she meant? It wasn't clear, and Harry felt the short hairs prickle on the back of his neck. Something, he repeated her.
A pet, a puppy, an accident,
she sighed.
"And some poor child's heart broken in Bonnyrigg, just this minute."
The necroscope felt his own heart give a start. He'd lost so much during his life that the thought of another's loss, however small, stung him with its poignancy. Or maybe it was just the way his mother had reported the occurrence so soulfully. Or there again, it could be an effect of his heightened emotional awareness. Maybe there was someone he could comfort.
"Bonnyrigg, did you say? Ma, I'll be going now. I'll come and see you tomorrow. Maybe you'll know something by then."
"Take care, son."
Harry stood up, looked up and down the river and across to the other side. The bright sun had passed behind fluffy drifting clouds, which was a relief. He climbed a tottering fence and entered a small copse, and in the dappled heart of the greenery conjured a Mobius door. A moment later, and he emerged into a back alley close to the high street in Bonnyrigg, and letting his dead speak sensitivity spread out around him like a fan or cobweb, he searched for a newcomer among the ranks of the dead. And there it was, close by, a whining yelp in memory of the panic and pain of a few moments ago, and a certain astonishment that the pain was no longer here, and disbelief that the bright day could so quickly turn black and blacker than night, a dumb animal's perception of sudden death. Harry understood it very well, for it wasn't too dissimilar to the reaction of a human being, the only difference being that dogs have neither foreknowledge of or preoccupation with death, so that their surprise is that much greater. But strike or kick a dog unjustly or cruelly, and it will draw back with just the same astonishment, the same disbelief. Taking a chance that he wasn't observed, the necroscope used the Mobius continuum to follow the pup's thoughts to their source. A curbside in the main village street, at a junction where the street turned left into the main road into Edinburgh. A work day, there weren't many people about. The handful which had gathered had their backs to Harry anyway, where he emerged onto the pavement as if from thin air, and the first thing he saw was the long, dark skid mark burned into the road's surface. The pup's dead-speak thoughts were more desperate now as it realized it couldn't extricate itself from this new predicament. There was no feeling, no contact, no light. Where was his god, its young master?
"Shush," Harry hushed. "It's okay, boy. It's all right. Shush."
He moved to the forefront of the handful of onlookers, saw a young boy kneeling there in the gutter, his cheeks shiny with tears, the broken pup dead in his arms. One of the pup's shoulders was askew and its spine kinked, its right foreleg flopped like a rubber band, its crushed head oozed brain fluid from a torn right ear. Harry got down on one knee, put an arm around the boy and stroked the dead pet. And again, "Shush, boy." He comforted both of them, and, in his mind, the pup's whines and yelps quietened to a panting whimper. It could feel again. It felt Harry. But the boy couldn't be comforted.
"He's dead," he kept moaning. "He's dead. Paddy's dead. But why didn't the car hit me and not Paddy? Why didn't the car stop?"
"Where do you live, son?" Harry asked the boy, a towhead of maybe 8 or 9. The other glanced at him through blurred blue eyes.
"Down there,"
he nodded vaguely over his right shoulder.
"Number 7. We live there, Paddy and me."
Harry took the dog gently into his arms and stood up. "Let's get home then," he said. The crowd parted for them, and Harry heard someone say,
"It's a shame. What a terrible shame. Paddy's dead."
The kid clutched the necroscope's elbow as they turned the corner into a narrow, deserted street. Dead? Yes, he was, but did he really have to be?
"You don't have to be, do you, Paddy?"
The dead-speak answer which came back wasn't quite a bark, and it wasn't quite a word, but it was an agreement. A dog will usually agree with his friends, and rarely, if ever, disagree with his master. While Harry wasn't Paddy's beloved master, he certainly was a new friend, and the decision was made as quickly as that. Before they reached the small garden in front of number 7, Harry looked down at the lad and said, "What's your name, son?"
"Peter."
The other could scarcely get it out past his tears and the lump in his throat.
Peter, I... Harry jerked to a halt. Placating for all he was worth, he glanced at the pet in his arms.
I think I felt him move.
The boy's mouth fell open.
Paddy moved? But he's so bad hurt.
Son, I'm a vet, Harry lied. Maybe I can save him. You run quickly now and tell your people what's happened, and I'll take Paddy to the surgery. And whatever happens, I'll be in touch just as soon as I know how bad he is. Or how good.
Okay, but...
Don't waste time, Peter, Harry urged. It's Paddy's life, right? The other gulped, nodded once, flew to the gate of number 7 and through it. And as he vanished pell-mell into the garden, Harry conjured a Mobius door. By the time Peter's ma came out of the house wringing her hands, came flying to see the vet, Harry was at a different address entirely. The necroscope had perhaps two friends among the living, but one of them was an old potter up in the Pentlands who fired his own kilns. Paddy was absolutely dead, no doubt of that, when Harry handed him over to Hamish McCulloch for calcination in one of his ovens.
It's worth 20 to me, Hamish, he told the old Scot, if you can bring him down to ashes, well, if not to me, to his master, a young lad with a broken heart, and I'll pay you for one of your pots, too, to keep him in.
I reckon we can manage that, Harry,
Hamish said, nodding. Only one thing, said the necroscope, be careful how you gather him up. I mean, the young lad wants to know he has all of him, right?
Just as you see.
And another nod. And Harry waited for 5 hours until the job was done, but stayed calm and patient and controlled throughout. For now he was the old Harry, who, while he had little enough time left of his own, nevertheless had all the time in the world for this. And anyway, it would serve his wider purposes too, wouldn't it? A little preview of what was to come, a chance to observe any possible discrepancies, for Trevor Jordan's brain had also been shattered and Penny's flesh had been torn. At 10 p.m, Harry was down in the spacious, dusty cellar of his old house, a mile or so out of Bonnyrigg. He'd cleaned the place out as best he could and scrubbed an area in the centre of the stone floor until it was smooth as glass. Old Hamish had told him the weight of the dead pup's body before calcination, so that even if Harry's grasp of math was meagre, it wouldn't be too difficult to calculate pound for pound the various amounts of chemicals required. His knowledge was anything but meagre, and he calculated it down into grams. Finally, ashes and chemicals were poured together, making a very small mound in the scrubbed floor space, and Harry was ready. And this time there was no pausing to check if his own personal mind flea was up and jumping, for this time he wasn't worried for himself, but a little kid who wouldn't be sleeping easy tonight. Except, now that it was ready, it all seemed so ridiculously easy. Was this all there was to it? Had he perhaps forgotten something? Had those weirdly esoteric words he'd uttered down in the bowels of Janus Ferenczi's ruined castle, the formula out of hideous eons, really sufficed to bring about resurrection? And if so, had it been an act of blasphemy? On the other hand, where was the prophet in worrying about that now? If the necroscope was to be damned for his works, then he was already damned. And purgatory has to be something like infinity. If you're to suffer for all eternity, there's no way you can be made to suffer twice as long, is there? As always, his arguments went in a circle, making his head spin, but suddenly he knew that it was the vampire in him working to confuse him, and in that same moment he acted and so broke the threat. Directing a rigid finger and his thoughts at the pile of ingredients, he spoke the words of evocation.
Ya naganaga yog sothoth hye legeb fai thradog oya.
It was like putting a lighted match to a pile of incendiary materials. There was phosphorescent light, coloured smoke, a not quite sulphur stench, and then there was a yelp.
Paddy, called up from his ashes, came staggering from a mushrooming smoke ring of rapidly dispersing gas or vapour. His ears and stump of a tail were down, trembling, and he wobbled on legs of jelly which seemed incapable of supporting him. He had returned from death and weightlessness, from incorporeity to life and substantiality in a moment, but his pup's legs were already unused to it. "Paddy?" the necroscope whispered, going down on one knee. "Paddy, here, boy." And the little dog fell down, stood up, shook himself as if to almost fall again, and came to him. Black and white, short in leg, floppy-eared, a mongrel entirely, and entirely alive. "Was he?" "Paddy?" The necroscope spoke again, this time in dead speak, but there was no answer. Paddy lived, truly. Half an hour later, Harry delivered Paddy to house number 7 of a row of neat terraced houses in Bonnyrigg. He didn't mean to stay, would escape immediately if he could, but there were things he needed to know about Paddy, about Paddy's character. Was he the same dog exactly? And apparently he was. Certainly Peter thought so. Paddy's master had been ready for bed for an hour, but he wouldn't go until he'd heard from his vet. And Paddy's return was a miracle to him, though only the necroscope knew how much a miracle. Peter's father was a tall, thin, calloused man, but a kind one.
"The boy told us he thought Paddy must be dead," he said, pouring Harry a liberal whiskey after Peter and his pup had disappeared for the night. "Broken bones, blood and brains from his ear, a spine all out of joint. It had us worried. He loves that pup."
"He looked a lot worse than it was," Harry answered. "The pup was unconscious, which made his limbs flop. There was some blood from a few scratches, and that always looks bad. And he'd coughed up some saliva. Shock, mostly." The other raised an eyebrow.
"And his shoulders? Peter said they weren't working, that they were definitely broken."
"Dislocated," Harry said. "Once we fixed that, everything else came right."
"We're grateful to you."
"That's okay.
What do we owe you?"
"Nothing."
"Well, that's very kind of you."
"I just wanted to be sure that Paddy was the same dog," said the necroscope. "I mean that the bump he took hasn't changed his personality. Did he seem the same to you?" There came a yelp and a bark and a laughter from Peter's bedroom.
"Playing,"
the boy's mother said, and smiled understandingly.
"They shouldn't be, but tonight's special. Oh, yes, Mr.
Keogh," said Harry. "Oh, yes, Paddy's just the same." Peter's father saw Harry to the garden gate, thanked him again, and said good night. When he went back inside, his wife said,
"What an uncommonly decent, nice person. His eyes so soulful."
Her husband was thoughtful.
"Didn't you think so?" "Oh, aye, certainly. But..."
"But?
Did you no like him, then? Is there something you can't trust in a man who won't accept payment for a job well done?"
"No, no, it's not that. But his eyes, soulful, weren't they?"
"Were they?"
"Down at the garden gate in the darkness when he looked at me."
"Yes."
"But nothing," said Peter's father, shaking his head. "A trick of the light, that's all." Back home, Harry felt good, better than at any time since Greece, when he'd got his dead speak and numeracy back. Maybe he could feel even better and cause others to feel better too. In his study, he sat in an easy chair and talked to an urn where it stood shadowed in one corner of the room. Or it would appear that he talked to the urn, but urns don't talk back. "Trevor, you were a telepath and a good one, which means that you still are, so I know that even when I don't speak to you, still you're listening to me. You listen to my thoughts, so you know what I did tonight, right?"
"I can't help what I am, Harry."
Trevor Jordan answered, his dead speak voice breathless with excitement.
"No more than you can. Yes, I know what you did, and what you're planning to do. I can't believe it yet, and don't suppose I will for quite some time after it's happened. If it happens, it's like a wonderful dream that I don't want to wake up from. except there's a chance it will be even more wonderful when I do wake up. There was no hope, none, and now there is.
But surely you knew my intention all along.
Knowing what someone wants to do doesn't make him capable of doing it,
the other answered.
And now after the dog.
Harry nodded. But a dog's a dog, and a man's a man. We still can't be sure until we're sure.
Do I have anything to lose?
I suppose not.
Harry, any time you're ready, then so am I. Boy, am I ready.
Trevor, just a second ago you said you can't help being what you are any more than I can. Did that mean more than it sounded? You must have read quite a lot in my mind. And after a long pause, I won't lie to you, Harry. I know what's happened to you, what you're becoming. You don't know how sorry I am.
Pretty soon, said the necroscope, the whole damn rat pack will be after me.
I know. And I know what you'll do then, and where you'll go. Again Harry's nod.
But it's like my ma told me, he said. It's a strange and sinister place. Any help I can get, I probably need it.
Is there something I can do?
Not much, I reckon. Not from where I am right now.
Actually, yes, said Harry. We could do it right now, but I won't take that sort of advantage. If the thing works, that will be soon enough. And even then, especially then, the decision will still be yours.
So when?
Again Jordan's breathlessness. Tomorrow?
Jesus!
But don't, the necroscope cautioned him then. Curse all you want, but be careful who you name. After that they talked generally and remembered old times. A pity there wasn't anything good to remember. Oh, good had come out of it, but it had been evil as hell at the time. And after a lull in their dead-speak conversation,
Harry, you know that Paxton's still watching you, don't you?
It was Jordan who had first brought the mind spy to the necroscope's attention. Harry remembered with gratitude, but ever since the initial warning a week ago, it had been his own intuition which had alerted him to the telepath's proximity. His first instinctive reaction to the problem had been to invoke a talent he'd inherited from Harold Wellesley, the ex-boss of E-Branch who had suicided after being found out as a double agent. Wellesley's talent had been a negative sort of thing. His mind had been better than the vaults of a bank, literally impregnable. But it had seemed to make him the ideal candidate for the head of the British Mind Spy Security Organization. Had seemed to, anyway. By way of atonement, he'd passed on his talent to Harry. But Wellesley's talent was sometimes a two-edged sword. If you bolt your door against your enemies, your friends get locked out too. Also, when you blow out the candle in a deep cave, everyone goes blind. Harry would prefer the light, prefer to know Paxton was there and what he was about. And, in any case, it was draining to have to keep his guard up like that. Power, all power, has to be generated somewhere, and with the necroscope's constantly increasing emotional stress, his batteries were already sufficiently drained. Now it was the business of Harry's intuition to keep tabs on the mind spy, his intuition and the expanding intelligence of the thing inside him, its waxing talents. Eventually, these would develop into a sort of telepathy in their own right, into telepathy and other forms of ESP. But it could do no harm to have Jordan's brand of art as an optional extra. Jordan heard that too.
Harry, there's no sweat on that. I know you're different. Anything I can give you, take it. Now or after you, try it out on me. It makes no difference. I'm not going to change my mind. You'll use it to protect yourself, of course you will, but not to hurt us, I'm sure.
Us?
People, Harry. I don't think you could hurt people.
I wish I could be sure. But the thing is, it won't be me. Or it will be, but I won't think the same anymore.
So all you have to do is to stick to your plan. When you know it's coming, or when the circumstances force you to take defensive or evasive action, that's when you get the hell out of it.
Chased out of my own world, the necroscope growled.
That or let the genie out of its bottle, yes.
You're a straight talker, Trevor.
Isn't that what friends are for?
But in a way you're a kind of genie in a bottle yourself, right?
Harry's contrary vampiric side was surfacing. His need to argue the point, any point. Jordan hadn't sensed it yet, but in any case he was trying to keep the conversation light. Maybe that's where those old Muslim legends spring from, eh? A man with the power who knows the magic words, calling up a powerful slave from dust into a bottle.
What is your wish, O master?
My wish? Harry's voice was gaunt as his face. Sometimes I wish to fuck I'd never been born. And now, Jordan sensed it, Harry's duality, the strange tides in his blood eroding the coastline of his will, the horror which challenged his human ascendancy even now, whose challenge was strengthening hour by hour, day by day. You're tired, Harry. Maybe you should take it easy for a while. Get some sleep. At night, the necroscope chuckled, but dryly, darkly. It's not my nature, Trevor.
You have to fight it.
I've been fighting it. Harry's growl was deeper. All I do is fight it. Jordan was silent for a moment. Then, maybe we should give it a break now. His dead speak was full of trembling. Harry could feel the fear, the terror of a dead man, and, to his innermost self, where Jordan couldn't reach. Oh, God, even the dead are afraid of me now. He stood up abruptly, starting to his feet so as to almost topple his chair, and lurching to the curtains, he looked out through an inch of space where the drapes came together across the river and into the night. At which precise moment, on the far river bank and under the trees there, someone struck a match to light a cigarette. Just for a second, Harry saw the flare before it was cupped into the windshield of a hand, and then there was only a yellow glow, brightening when the watcher took a deep drag. The bastard's out there right now, Harry spoke almost to himself. It might as well be to himself, for Jordan was too frightened to answer. Chapter 5 The Resurrected. At midnight, Harry was still seething. He invoked Wellesley's talent, crept out into his garden and down the path where the old gate in the wall sagged on its rusting hinges. The night was his friend, and like a cat he became one with the shadows until it would seem there was no one there at all. Looking through the gapped gate across the river, his night-sensitive eyes could plainly see the motionless figure under the trees, the mind-flea Paxton. Paxton! The word was like poison on Harry's lips and in his mind. His mind, or that of the creature which was now a growing part of him. For Harry's vampire recognized the threat even as the necroscope himself, except it might deal with it differently, if he would let it. Paxton! He breathed the name into the cool night air, and his breath was a mist that drifted to the path and swirled around his ankles. The essence of vampiry was strong in him now, almost overpowering. You can't hear me, you bastard, can you? He breathed mist, which flowed under the gate, across the overgrown river path, down among the brambles and onto the glassy water itself. You can't read me. You don't know I'm here at all, do you? But suddenly, coming from nowhere, there was a gurgling, monstrous voice, unmistakably that of Feythor Ferenczi, in Harry's mind.
Instead of shrieking back when you sense him near, seek him out. He would enter your mind, enter his. He will expect you to be afraid, be bold. And when he yawns his jaws at you, go in through them, for he's softer on the inside.
A nightmare voice, but one which Harry himself had drawn from memory, for Wellesley's talent made any other sort of intrusion impossible. Feythor was gone now, where no man could ever reach him. He was lost forever in future time. That father of vampires had been talking about his blood son, Janus, but it seemed to the necroscope that the same techniques might well apply right here, right now. Or perhaps it didn't seem so to Harry, but to the thing inside him. Paxton was here to prove Harry was a vampire,
Since he was a vampire, there seemed no way he could disprove it. But must he simply sit still and wait for the consequences of this flea's reports? The urge was on him to even the score a little, to give the mind spy something to think about. Not to actually scratch his itch, no, for that would be conclusive proof in itself, and could only drag the necroscope further into an already unwelcome light, ultimately to the minute scrutiny of bigger fleas, whose bite might even prove fatal. Also, Harry was obliged to forcibly remind himself, it would be murder. The thought of that evoked visions of blood, and the thought of that was something he must put aside entirely. He stepped back from the gate in the old stone wall, conjured a door, and passed through it into the Mobius continuum, and out again onto a second-class road where it paralleled the river on its far side. There was no one in sight. The sky was clouded over. Down through the flanking trees the river was seen as a ribbon of lead, carelessly let fall in the darkness. A car, Paxton's car, a recent model and expensive, stood half on, half off the road under overhanging branches. Its paintwork gleamed in the dark. Its doors were locked, windows wound up tight. It pointed slightly downhill towards a walled bend where the access road joined the main road into Bonnyrigg. Harry stepped from the potholed tarmac, past the car, and into the cover of the trees, and where he went, the mist followed. No, it didn't simply follow, for he was the source and the catalyst. It boiled up from the ground where he walked, fell from his dark clothes like weird evaporation, poured from his mouth as breath. He went silently, flowing, unaware of his own feet, unerringly seeking soft ground, stepping between the places where brittle, betraying twigs lay in wait for him. And he felt his tenant flexing its muscles and securing its hooks more deeply in his will. It would be a fine test of the thing's power over him, to take control here and now, causing him to do that from which there could be no return. Until now, Harry's fever had been more or less controlled. His angers had been more violent, true, his depressions deeper, and his snatches of joy poignant, but on the whole he had felt no real craving or compulsion, or at least nothing he couldn't fight. But now he felt it. It was as if Paxton had become the centre of all that was wrong with his life, a point he could focus upon, a large wen on the already imperfect complexion of existence. Some surgery was required. Harry's mist crept ahead of him. It sprang up from the bank of the river and the boles of trees where they join the damp earth and cast swirling tendrils about Paxton's feet. The telepath sat on a tree stump close to the river's rim, his gaze fixed firmly on the dark shape of the house across the water, where light spilled out from an upstairs window. Harry had left that light on deliberately, but while the necroscope was unaware of it, still there was a half-scowl, half-frown on Paxton's face, for the mind spy had lost his quarry's aura. He supposed that Harry was still in the house, but for all his mental concentration, he no longer had contact with him, not even the tenuous contact which was his minimum requirement. It didn't mean a great deal, of course not, because Paxton was well aware of Harry's talents. The necroscope could be literally anywhere, or on the other hand, it could mean quite a bit. It isn't everyone who will just go flitting off into the midnight hour, putting himself beyond the reach of men and mentalists alike. Keogh could be up to almost anything. Paxton shivered as a ghost stepped on his grave. Only an old saying, that, of course. But for a moment, just then, he'd felt something touch him, like an unseen presence come drifting across the water to stand beside him in the silence of the mist-shrouded riverbank. Mist-shrouded? Where the hell had that sprung from? He stood up, looked to the left and right, and began to turn around. And Harry, not 5 paces away, stepped silently into darkness. Paxton turned through a full, slow circle, shivered again, and shrugged uncomfortably, and continued to stare at the house across the river. He reached inside his coat and brought out a leather-jacketed flask, tilted it, and let strong liquor gurgle into his throat in a long pull. Watching the Esper empty the flask, Harry could feel something dark swelling inside him. It was big, maybe even bigger than he was. He flowed forward, came to a halt directly behind the unsuspecting telepath. What a joke it would be to let go of Wellesley's shield right now and deliberately aim his thoughts into the back of Paxton's head. Why, the Esper would probably leap straight into the river. Or perhaps he'd just turn around again very slowly and see Harry standing there looking right at him, into him, into his quivering, quaking soul. And then, if he went to scream... The dark alien, hate-swollen thing was in Harry's hands now, lifting them towards the back of Paxton's neck. It was in his heart, too, and his eyes and his face. He could feel it pulling back his lips from drooling teeth. It would be so easy to sweep Paxton up and into the Mobius Continuum and deal with him there, there where no one would ever find him. Harry's hands only had to close now, and he could wring the Esper's neck like he was a chicken.
Ha!
The thing inside sang of emotions as yet unattained, which could be his. He thrilled to its message, to the ringing cry which echoed through his innermost being even now.
Vampiri! Vam!
And Paxton hitched back the sleeve of his overcoat and glanced at his watch. That was all. His movement had been such a natural thing, so mundane, so much of this world, that the spell of an alien plane of existence was broken, and Harry felt like he was a 12-year-old boy again, masturbating furiously over the toilet bowl and ready to come, and his uncle had just knocked on the bathroom door. He drew back from Paxton, conjured a Mobius door, and almost toppled through it. Too late and mercifully so, the mind spy sensed something and whirled about, and saw nothing there but a swirl of fog. Drenched in his own pungent sweat, the necroscope vacated the Mobius Continuum into the back seat of Paxton's car, and he sat there shuddering, retching and being physically ill onto the floor until he'd sicked the thing right out of himself. At last, looking at the stinking mess of his own vomit, his anger gradually returned. And now he was mainly angry with himself. He'd set out to teach the Esper a lesson and had almost killed him. It said a hell of a lot for his control over the thing inside him, which as yet was, what, a baby, an infant? What hope would he have later then, when the thing was full-fledged? And still Paxton was there under the trees by the riverbank, there with his thoughts and his cigarettes and his whiskey. And he'd probably be there tomorrow too, and the day after that, until Harry made a mistake and gave himself away, if he hadn't done so already. "Fuck him," Harry said out loud, bitterly. Yes, screw him, shaft the bastard, which had to be better than murdering him at least. He climbed over into the front seat of the car and took off the brake, and felt the wheels slowly turn as she began to roll. He guided the car fully onto the road and let gravity take her along. Rolling down the gentle gradient, the vehicle gained momentum. Harry pumped at the accelerator until he could smell the heavy petrol fumes, pulled out the choke and pumped some more. A quarter mile later, he was still pumping and the car was doing maybe 25-30. The curve was coming up fast, with its grass verge and high stone wall. Harry let go the wheel, conjured a Mobius door out of the seat behind him, and slid over into it. And 2 seconds later, Paxton's car mounted the verge, hit the wall, and went off like a bomb. Just that moment, returning from the river to the road, the Esper stared uncomprehendingly at the spot where his car had stood, then heard the explosion further down the road and saw a ball of fire rising into the night, and,
"What?" he said. "What?"
By then, Harry was home again, dialing 999. He got an emergency operator in Bonnyrigg, who put him through to the police station.
"Police? How can we help you?"
The voice was heavily accented. "There's a car just burst into flames on the access road to the old estate. behind Bonnie Rig, Harry said breathlessly, and passed on full details of the location. And there's a man there drinking with a hip flask and warming his hands on the fire.
Who's speaking, please?
The voice was more authoritative now, alert and very official sounding. Can't stop, said Harry. Have to see if anyone's hurt. He put the phone down. From his upstairs bedroom window, the necroscope watched the fire steadily brightening, and 10 minutes later saw the Bonnie Rig fire engine arrive along with its police escort. And for a little while there was the eerie wailing of sirens where blue and orange flashing lights clustered around the central leap of flames. Then the fire winked out and the sirens were silenced, and a little after that the police car drove off, with a passenger. Harry would have been happy to know that the passenger was Paxton, furiously swearing his innocence and breathing whiskey fumes all over the hard-faced officers. But he didn't, because by then he was fast asleep. Whether sleep at night was right or wrong for his character made no difference. Trevor Jordan's advice had been sound. In the morning, the rising sun scorched Harry from his bed. Coming up beyond the river, it crept in through his window and seared a path across a twitching left hand, which he dreamed was trapped in one of Hamish McCulloch's kilns. Starting awake, he saw the room flooded with glowing yellow sunlight, where he'd mistakenly left the curtains open. He breakfasted on coffee, just coffee, and immediately proceeded to the cool cellar. He didn't know how long he had left, so it might as well be a case of now or never, and anyway he'd promised Trevor Jordan it would be today. Jordan's and Penny's urns were already down below, along with the chemicals Harry had taken from the castle forensi. Trevor, he said as he weighed and mixed powders, I went after Paxton last night. No, not seriously, but almost. All I did in the end was toss a spanner in his works, which should keep him out of our hair a while. I certainly don't feel him near, but that could be because it's morning and the sun is up. Can you tell me if he's out there?
The news agent in Bonnie Rig has just opened his shop and there's a milkman doing his rounds, Jordan answered. Oh, and a lot of perfectly ordinary people in the village are having breakfast, but no sign of Paxton. It seems a pretty normal sort of morning to me.
Not exactly normal, Harry told him. Not for you, anyway.
I've been trying not to hope too hard,
Jordan answered, his dead speak shivery.
Try not to pray. I still keep thinking I'm dreaming. I mean, we actually do shut down and sleep sometimes. Did you know that?
The necroscope nodded, finished his powders, and took up Jordan's urn. I was incorporeal myself one time, remember? I used to get tired as hell. Mental exhaustion is far worse than physical. For a while, as he carefully poured Jordan's ashes, there was silence. Then,
Harry, I'm not scared to talk.
Scared? Harry repeated the word almost automatically, concentrated on breaking the urn with a hammer, and laying its pieces with the insides uppermost around a heap of mortal remains and chemical catalysts, so that anything clinging to them would get caught up in it when he spoke the words.
Scared, excited, you name it. But if I had guts, I'd throw them up, I'm sure.
It was time. Trevor, you have to understand that if you're not right, I mean...
I know what you mean, I know.
Okay. Harry nodded and moistened his dry lips. So here we go. The words of evocation came as easy as his mother tongue, and yet with a growl which denied his human heritage. He used his art with pride, certainly in the knowledge that it was a very uncommon thing, and that he was a most uncommon creature.
Yeah!
The final exclamation wasn't quite a snarl, and it was answered a moment later by a cry almost of agony. The necroscope stepped back as swirling purple smoke filled the cellar, stinging his eyes. It gouted, mushroomed, spilled from, or was residue of the chemical materia. It was the very essence of Ginny, its massive volume spilling from such a small source. And staggering forward out of it, crying out the pain of his rebirth, came the naked figure of Trevor Jordan. But the necroscope was ready, in case this birth must be aborted. For a moment, Harry could see very little in the swirl of chemical smoke, and for another, only a glimpse, a wild staring eye, a twisted gaping mouth, head only partly visible, only partly there. Jordan's arms were reaching out for Harry, his hands shuddering, almost vibrating. His legs gave way, and he fell to one knee. Harry felt the chill of absolute horror, and the words of devolution sprang to his mind, were ready in his desiccated lips. Then the smoke cleared, and it was Trevor Jordan kneeling there, perfect. Harry sank to his knees and embraced him, both of them crying like children. Then it was Penny's turn. She, too, thought she was dreaming, couldn't believe what the necroscope told her with his dead speak. But it was one dream from which he soon awakened her. She fell into his arms, crying, and he carried her up out of the cellar to his bedroom, laid her between the sheets and told her to try to sleep. All useless. There was a maniac in the house, running wild, laughing and crying at the same time. Trevor Jordan came and went, slamming doors, rushing here and there, pausing to touch himself, to touch Harry, Penny, and then laughing again, laughing like crazy, like mad. Mad to be alive. Penny, too, once the truth sank in, once she believed, and for an hour, 2 hours, it was bedlam. Stay in bed? She dressed herself in Harry's pyjamas and one of his shirts, and danced. She pirouetted, waltzed, jived. Harry was glad he had no neighbours. Eventually they wore themselves out, almost wore the necroscope out, too. He made plenty of coffee for them. They were thirsty, they were hungry, they invaded his kitchen, they ate everything. Now and then Jordan would leap to his feet, hug Harry until he thought his ribs must crack, rush into the garden and feel the sunshine, and rush back again, and Penny would burst into a fresh bout of tears and kiss him. It made him feel good, and it disturbed him. Even now their emotions were no match for his. Then it was afternoon, and Harry said, "Penny, I think you can go home now." He had told her what she must say, how it couldn't have been her body the police found, but someone who looked a lot like her, how she had suffered amnesia or something and didn't know where she'd been until she found herself in her own street, in her own North Yorkshire village. That was all, no elaborating, and no mention, not even a whisper, of Harry Keogh, necroscope. He made a note of her sizes. Mobius tripped into Edinburgh and bought her clothes, waited while she frantically dressed herself. He had forgotten shoes. No matter, she'd go barefoot. She would go naked if that were the only way. He took her home, almost all the way, only breaking the jump for a final word of warning on the rolling moors via the Mobius continuum, which was something else for her not to believe in, and he cautioned her, "Penny, from now on things will be normal for you. And eventually you may even come to believe this story we've concocted for you. Better for you, me, everyone, if you do believe it. Most certainly better for me.
But I'll see you again."
The realization of what she had found and what she must lose, and for the first time the question, did she have the better of the bargain? He shook his head. "People will come and go, Penny, through all your life. It's the way it is. And through death? You've promised me you'll forget that. It isn't part of our story, right?" And then the rest of the jump, to the street corner she'd known all her life. "Goodbye, Penny." And when she looked around, as a small child she'd followed a rerun adventure of the Lone Ranger. Who was that masked man? Back at the house near Bonnyrigg, Jordan was waiting. He was calmer now, but still radiated awe and wonder, which made him look beautiful, fresh scrubbed, newly returned from a holiday in the sun or a swim in a mountain stream. All of these things. "Harry, I'm ready any time you are. Just tell me what I must do." "You? Nothing. Just don't shut me out, that's all. I want to get into your mind and learn from it."
"Like Janus did?"
Harry shook his head. "Unlike Janus did. I didn't bring you back to hurt you. I didn't even bring you back for me. It's still up to you. If you don't like the idea of me going in there, just say so. This has to be your own free will." Very significant words. Jordan looked at him. "You didn't just save my life," he said.
but returned it to me. Anything you want, Harry.
The necroscope sent his developing Vampiri thoughts directly into Jordan's head, and the other cleared the way for him, drew him in. Harry found what he wanted. It was so like Deadspeak that he knew it at once. The mechanism was easy, a part of the human psyche. Mental in action, it was purely physical in operation, a part of the mind that people, most people, haven't learned how to use. Identical twins sometimes have it, because they come from the same egg. But discovering it wasn't the same as making it work. Harry withdrew and said, "Your turn." For Jordan it was easy. He already was a telepath. He looked inside Harry's mind and found the trigger which the necroscope had pictured for him. It only required releasing. After that, like a switch, Harry could throw it any time it was required. "And try it," Jordan said when he'd withdrawn. Harry pictured Zekphona, a powerful telepath in her own right, and reached out with his new talent. She was swimming in the blue waters of the Mediterranean, spearfishing off Zakynthos, where she lived with her husband, Jazz Simmons. She was 20 feet down and had lined up a fish in her sights, a fine red mullet, where it finned on the sandy bottom and ogled her.
"Testing, testing, testing," said Harry, with more than a hint of dry humour.
She sucked in salt water down the tube of her snorkel, triggered off her spear and missed, dropped her gun and kicked frantically for the surface, and she trod water there, coughing and spluttering, staring wildly all about, until suddenly it came to her that the words could only have been in her head, but the mental voice had been unmistakable. Finally, she had her breath back and got her thoughts together.
"Harry?"
And from his house in Bonnyrigg, 1,500 miles away.
"The one and only," he answered.
"Harry, you a telepath?"
Her confusion was total.
"I didn't mean to startle you, Zek. Just wanted to find out how good I am."
"Well, you're good. I might have drowned."
A swimmer like Zek? There was no way she might have drowned, but suddenly she backed off, and the necroscope knew that she'd sensed the other thing that was Harry Keogh. She tried to shut it out of her thoughts, but he cut right through her confusion with,
"It's okay, Zek. I know that you know about me. I just think you should also know that it won't be like that with me. I'm not staying here. Not for long, anyway. I've a job to do, and then I'll be on my way."
"Back there?"
She read it in his mind.
"To begin with, but there may be other places. You of all people know that I can't stay here."
"Harry,"
she was quick, anxious to return.
"You know I won't go up against you."
"I know that, Zek."
She was silent for a long time. Then Harry had a thought.
"Zek, if you'll swim back to the beach, there's someone here would like a word with you. But better if you have your feet firmly on the beach, because you won't believe who it is and what he has to say. And this time you really might drown."
And he was right. She didn't believe it. Not for quite some time. About the middle of the afternoon, when Jordan had finally accepted everything and the glow had gone off him a little, he said,
"What about me, Harry? Can I just go home?"
"I may have made a mistake," the necroscope told him then. "Darcy Clark knows I had the girl's ashes. He might figure it out. If he does, he'll know I have a couple more talents now, which will be confirmed, and how, if you show up. And anyway, I have this feeling that everything is going to blow up soon. You can go any time you like, Trevor, but I'd appreciate it if you stay here and out of sight a while longer."
"How long?"
Harry shrugged. "I have a job to do. That long. Not much more than 4 or 5 days, I should think."
"That's okay, Harry," Jordan said.
"I can stand that, or 4 or 5 weeks if I have to."
"What will you do, anyway?"
"Back to the branch."
"It was a good living. It paid the bills. We got things done."
"Then it's best that you leave it until I've gone. You'll have to know that they'll be coming for me."
"After all you've done for us? For everybody?"
Again, Harry shrugged. "When an old, faithful dog savages your child, you have to put him down. His services in the past don't cut it. What's more, if you knew for certain he was going to savage your child, you'd put him down first, right? and afterwards you might even feel sorry for the old guy and cry a little. But hell, if you also knew he had rabies, why, you wouldn't even think twice. You'd do it for him as much as for anyone else. Jordan played it straight, face to face. Does it really worry you that much? I mean, let's face it, Harry, it won't be an easy job, taking you out. Janus Ferenzi had a lot going for him, but he wasn't in the same league as you are now. That's why I have to go. If I don't, I'll be forced to defend myself, which can only hasten things, and then there'd be a chance for this curse to go on forever. I didn't spend all that time doing all of that. Dagasani, Thibor, Janus, Faithor, Yulin Badescu, just to end up the same way they did. In that case, maybe I should go. I mean, now. Oh? I can stay out of sight, keep an eye on them for you. They have Paxton watching you, but they won't know that I'm watching them. They don't even know I'm alive. I mean, they do know I'm dead. Harry was interested. Go on. Darcy will be the man to watch, not in the office, but when he's home. I know where he lives and I know how he thinks. You'll be on his mind a lot, both ways, because of what you are, and also because he's a good sort of bloke and he'll just be, well, thinking about you. So when everything looks set to go down, I'll know, and then I'll get back to you. You'd do that for me? Harry knew he would. Don't I owe it to you? Harry nodded slowly. It's a good idea, he finally said. Okay, go after nightfall. I'll drive you into Edinburgh, and then you're on your own. And he did. And then the necroscope was on his own too, but not for long. The next morning Paxton was back. His presence turned Harry's mood sour in a moment, but he promised himself that later he would turn the tables and take a look inside Paxton's mind for a change. He relished the thought of that. But first, he would go and see his ma and find out if she had anything for him. The sky was overcast and he stood on the river bank, with his collar coat turned up against a thin but penetrating, persistent drizzle. Any success, ma?
Harry, is that you, son?
Her dead speak was so thin, so far off sounding, that for a moment the necroscope thought it was simply background static. The whispers of the teeming dead conversing in their graves. It's me, Ma, yes, but you're awfully faint.
I know, son,
she answered from afar.
Just like you, I don't have a lot of time now. Not here, anyway. It's all fading now, everything. Did you want something, Harry?
She seemed very weary and wondering. Ma, he was patient with her, just like in the old days. Since I've been having some difficulty with the dead, we'd decided that you would help me out and see if they'd be a bit more forthcoming with you. About those poor murdered girls, I mean. You said I should give you a little more time, then come and see you again, so here I am. I still need the information, Ma.
Murdered girls?
She repeated him, however vaguely. But then Harry sensed a sudden focusing of her attention as her dead speak sounded sharper in his unique mind.
Of course, those dead poor murdered girls, those innocents, except, well, they weren't all innocents, Harry.
In my book they were, Ma. For my purposes they were. But tell me, what do you mean?
Well, most of them wouldn't speak to me, she answered. It seemed they'd been warned off, warned about you. When it comes to vampires, the dead aren't very forgiving, Harry. The one who would speak to me... She'd been one of the first of his victims, whoever he is, but by no means an innocent. She was a prostitute, son, foul-mouthed and minded, and she was willing to talk about it and said she wouldn't mind talking to you. In fact, she said more than that.
Oh?
Yeah, she said that it would make a nice change to just talk to a man.
Harry's ma tut-tutted.
And so young, so very young.
Ma, said Harry, I'm going to go and see that one soon, but you're getting so faint that I don't know if we'll ever get to talk again. So I just thought I'd tell you right now that you've been the best mother anyone could ever have, and...
And you've been the best son, Harry.
She cut him off.
But listen, don't you cry for me, and I promise I won't cry for you. I lived a good life, son,
and despite a cruel death, I've not been too unhappy in my grave. You were responsible for what happiness I found, Harry, just as you've been for so much of what passes for happiness in this place. That the dead no longer trust you, well, that's their loss.
He blew her a kiss. I missed a lot when you were taken from me, but of course you missed a lot more. I hope there is a place beyond death, Ma, and that you make it there.
Harry, there's something else.
She was fading very quickly now, so that he must give her all his attention or lose her dead speak entirely.
About August Ferdinand.
August Ferdinand? About Mobius? Harry remembered his last conversation with the great mathematician. Ah, he chewed his lips. Well, it would be that I insulted Mobius, Ma. Inadvertently, you understand. I mean, I wasn't quite myself that time.
He said you weren't, son, and that he wouldn't be speaking with you again.
Oh, said Harry, a little crestfallen. Mobius had been one of his very best and closest friends. I see.
No, you don't see, Harry,
his mother contradicted him.
He won't be speaking to you because he won't be there. I mean, here. He, too, has somewhere else to go, or believes he has. Anyway, he talked about a lot of things I didn't much understand. Space and time, space-time, the cone-shaped universes of light. I think that covers everything. And he said your argument left one big question unanswered.
Oh?
Yes, the question of the Möbius continuum itself.